And welcome to another edition of Gillespie on Tuesday nights here on FTRradio.com. We're leading off the exciting, power-packed evening that you can find here on FTR Radio, and I thank you all for joining us. I think I'm an optimist by nature. I prefer to see the glasses being half full, and that's just one of many reasons that I'm a Republican. While I do think some caution is required, my optimism and my experience is telling me that Nancy Pelosi's days as House Speaker are numbered. Funny thing is, I think Speaker Pelosi knows it as well. She knows that her days as a queen reigning over the most ethical Congress ever are coming to an end this November. Even better, most Democrats know it as well. Heck, I even suspect that TOTUS knows this, though I'm not sure he's going to tell the president. Because of this, I think it's rather obvious that Speaker Pelosi is scrambling at this very moment, scrambling to find a way to cement her legacy as the first female speaker in history. Coming from the People's Republic of San Francisco has some debts to pay to all of her far-left supporters who've made her brief reign possible. Add to the fact the reality that a large number of sitting House Democrats are going to lose their seats and retire to a life of lobbying for unions or returning to ambulance chasing, we're staring at a very real and very awful reality in the face. The likelihood that Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi's far-left agenda will be rammed down our nation's throats via what is known as a lame duck session, meaning a session that would include a number of House members who have already lost their seats but who have the chance to leave behind some real nasty stink bombs for their successors and ultimately for us as a nation. Of course, our friends on the left are attempting to brush this off as some sort of crazy conspiracy or mere paranoia. In fact, Democratic Congressman Chris Van Hollen actually used the term paranoia while denying that Democrats were planning to vote on controversial legislation. However, just like the character in the novel Catch-22 said, just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean everyone is out to get me. In other words, just because we're paranoid, as a number of Democrats are claiming, doesn't mean there isn't something to this. How do I know this? White House advisor Carol Browner recently suggested on a Sunday morning talk show that the administration could try to revive the stalled cap-and-trade legislation during a lame duck session. Senator Harry Reid has already outlined a plan for a lame duck session. In addition to spending bills, Reid has suggested he might seek to enact a new round of loans and tax breaks for small businesses. He has also spoken about trying to implement rapidly some of the recommendations put forward by the Deficit Reduction Commission that President Obama appointed and whose findings are due to be submitted by December 1st. So we have two options to deal with when considering the whole idea of a lame duck session. One is, we can simply trust the Democrats in Congress when they say there won't be any controversial items voted on during the lame duck session. Surely we can take Congressman Van Hollen at his word when he states, it's a made-up issue. There's no plan to do any kind of big controversial legislation. Because what we all know that we can trust Democrats when they tell us that there is nothing to fear here, right? I mean, considering how the healthcare reform bill was rammed through the Senate on a technicality, we can look at the record of Democrats in Congress and see that there's a lot to trust. Yeah, and I've got some hope and change for you if you actually believe that nonsense. But I've got something for you to chew on for a second. Right now, Congress is in a summer recess, but they'll be back by September 14th. From September 14th until November is more than a month. That's more than a month for Democrats to ram through their extremist agenda, which should be more than enough time. Interestingly enough, they aren't. So that means no cap and trade to increase your utility bills and put more people out of work. No bills to institute a brand new tax, this time the so-called value-added tax that Democrats are calling for. No card check bill, which would virtually strip an employer's rights in the workplace regarding unionization. You'd think a month would be plenty of time to turn this nation into the People's Republic of America, but the Democrats on the Hill are chickening out. What do I mean by chickening out? They won't try to put these bills to a vote before the election because they know the American people are against them. They know that passing such extremist legislation would turn an already bleak election cycle into an Armageddon, the likes of which Democrats haven't seen since Walter Mondale ran for president in 1984. So instead, they'll try to wait until this so-called lame duck session, when the Democrats in the House have already been voted out and have lost any trace of accountability to their constituents before continuing our march into socialism. This type of sneak attack on American values will be the lasting legacy of the Pelosi Congress, even beyond the endless parade of ethics investigations arising from the most ethical Congress ever. That's why Bill Clinton once said, you know, it's just one small step from a legacy to lame duck. In this case, it's almost one and the same. But let's play congressman for a day for a second, shall we? What would we actually do if we could pretend that we were in charge for a day? I don't mean we as in Republicans. I mean we as in you and me. What would we do if I were Speaker Josh Gillespie and you were a fellow member of Congress? How about reforming our tax code in order to maximize revenue while at the same time reducing the burdens on Americans? Why not look at lowering our corporate tax burden, which at 40% is the second highest in the world? Did you know that the average corporate tax rate for members of the OECD is only 26%? What impact would you imagine that having such a high tax rate might be having on our corporations? While we're at it, why not eliminate our current practice of taxing corporate income that's earned overseas? Anyone want to ponder whether that might have something to do with why so many corporations are moving overseas? Here's another suggestion. Let's stop taxing so many businesses as individuals and instead include them in our lowered corporate tax rate. Considering the small businesses are the engine behind job growth in this country, I'm guessing that might have an impact. While we're at it, let's eliminate the death tax once and for all. Why does it make sense to tax income when it's earned and then tax it again when you die? Eliminating this harmful tax will certainly help spur economic recovery, put unemployed Americans back to work, as well as increase the long-term growth potential of the economy. More importantly, repealing it would restore the American dream that if you work hard and live a virtuous life, you can pass the fruits of your labor to succeeding generations of your family without fear that the government will take it away from them. That's the America that many generations have dreamed of living in. You see, friends, these are actual ideas, and ones that we can prove work, and ones that will begin to turn things around in this country. These are the ideas that spring forth from the fertile soil of a free people living in a free nation. Even better, these are the ideas that wouldn't require a sneaky and shadowy lame duck session run by people who've just lost their grip on power and have literally nothing to lose if their policies continue to shove this country further down the abyss. These are just a few of my thoughts and ideas. I would invite you to join me over at joshgillespie.net and at hoosieraccess.com to continue this discussion. And I hope you'll share with me some of your own ideas for how we can help to begin to right this glorious ship we all live on. Now, I just want to invite you guys to stay on for this episode. We're going to be looking back at some of our, a couple of our previous interviews, looking into the Gillespie archive, so to speak. And we'll be reviewing our interview with State Representative Jackie Walorski, who is running for Congress in Indiana. She's running against Joe Donnelly up in the 2nd Congressional District. That name, Joe Donnelly, may ring familiar to you as he is running against being a Democrat, even though he is a Democrat. He's been featured, his advertisement actually has been featured plenty on Fox News as one of the many Democrats who are running against the Pelosi agenda in Washington. We'll also be speaking with the chairman of the Indiana Right to Life, Mike Fichter. We want to take a look back there because it was just last month that Lila Rose released a video of a sting video of what takes place at a local Indianapolis Planned Parenthood center. The video is disturbing. The conversation that you hear between the person who is acting as a client, so to speak, the conversation she has with a nurse, it's just disturbing. And finally, I will bring it back, and I'm actually going to be recapping my experience on September 11th. I was a fresh green staffer out in Washington, D.C., who had just started a job working on for the Committee on Government Reform, which at the time was chaired by Congressman Dan Burton. So we'll bring it back to some fresh new material, but looking back on an experience that is something on a day that we will all remember. So I encourage you to stick around, listen to Jackie, listen to Mike Fichter, and then just recap what took place on September 11th. I hope you stick around.
All right, and welcome back to Gillespie. I'm here with my crew of Christy Kelly, Mark Warner, and Mike Jazerski. On the phone we have State Representative and 2nd Congressional District candidate from Indiana, Jackie Walorski. Jackie, thank you for being on our show. I know this isn't the first time that you've been on FTR Radio, so we're glad that you've come back, and I'm pleased that you're on our show.
Well, I appreciate you guys. Thanks for the opportunity. It's great to hear from you.
Well, kind of give us a quick wrap-up of your campaign so far. Notice that you just got the big endorsement from Eric Cantor yesterday.
We did. And, you know, we had National Right to Life this week as well, which is huge. It's huge for me, and it's huge for this district, especially in light of the health care vote that Joe Donnelly passed with the two-pack pack and turning their backs on that issue. But, you know, by and large, this campaign has taken off. It's been like rocket fuel poured on fire. I mean, it's been unbelievable since primary. And that's been very encouraging to us because we have a massive grassroots network, probably second only to the governor in the state. And, you know, we are doing this 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, and building an army to turn this seat. And so we've received a lot of national attention. We're a highly targeted race at the national level. And, you know, we're just going around listening to what folks are saying. And there's pretty much consistent themes, which are people in the second district are upset about massive deficit spending in general, and health care, and then the whole concept of where are the jobs that were promised. So, you know, I was at a festival this morning, Josh, and it was amazing. Of everybody there, you know, the people that were lined up to talk to us and talk to me about this race, and they're very excited. There are a lot of Democrats, crossover voters, and, you know, it's been phenomenal. It's just been great momentum. We have a big kickoff tomorrow in Elkhart for our fall campaign, a big fall kickoff at 2 o'clock, and we're expecting a couple thousand people to show up. So I would say that we're on the march, and the 2nd District is well within sight of flipping.
Has anybody actually seen Joe Donnelly sweating yet? Because I have to imagine that he is.
Well, he doesn't show up much with me in public. I mean, he seldom shows up if I'm someplace. I mean, we're in parades together, of course. Outside of that, we're usually not side by side. Usually when he sees us, the blood runs from his face. He turns very white and doesn't have much to say. And I'll tell you this. I mean, people are very, very vocal about their opposition to what he's voted for. And so I'm not sure he goes in public much without a lot of reinforcements around him.
Well, what you've been hitting Joe pretty hard recently, especially on a lot of his budget-busting votes. What do you plan to do if you're elected to Congress to help kind of bring down and pare down this massive spending that we're seeing in Washington right now?
Well, good question, Josh. You know, the reason I'm running for Congress is not because I'm looking for something to do. I didn't run for the State House because I was looking for something to do. I wasn't bored. I knew I could contribute something in the state of Indiana, and we were looking at, you know, almost $1 billion of deficit, and you know, we've been able to take our state to almost a $2 billion surplus without a tax increase, and in the middle of a recession have a AAA bond rating. It's because we learned to leverage private money from the outside in our state, not public money. And that's exactly what has to happen in D.C. That's why I'm going there, is to be a part of and to take the lead in freezing this budget at the federal level, cutting it, shrinking it back like we did in the state of Indiana, getting rid of every piece of excess thing that we have, including agencies, and pare this thing down so that we can live within our means, and so working Hoosiers actually have something to look forward to, you know, in things like retirement and their children's education, and not having to just live and work for the government. And Indiana has a great story to tell. We have a story that very few states can tell and needs to be told at the federal level. So I'm all about freezing, shrinking, and cutting that federal deficit, that federal budget, to get us back underneath the deficit.
Yeah, our first guest was today was Representative Dave Frizzell, who I know you're friends with. And one of our closing questions was how, in a time when national Republicans were losing their way on fiscal issues, Indiana, with the leadership of Mitch Daniels and Brian Bosma when he was Speaker of the House, you guys actually slashed the budget. You were fiscal hawks.
And that has to happen at the national level, and that's what people should expect of their representatives. People ought to be expecting that across the board. And I'll tell you this, Josh. I was in D.C. about a month ago, and it was amazing to me how many people that I met that were running for Congress on the Republican ticket were envious of the fact that I'm from the state of Indiana, and I have a story to tell, and it's because of the governor, it's because of the leadership our party's had, it's because of the decisions we made as representatives, and we stood there and took it in the teeth, and we didn't back down. And it's amazing. I mean, literally, when the governor talks about all heads returning to Indiana, they are, because we have just done what most people are talking about. And that's the difference between me and Joe Donnelly. And that's why I can go and look anybody in the eye and say, I can promise you I'll do the same thing we just did, and it'll work. And Hoosiers get that.
Well, this past week, we had Pelosi and Hoyer up there saying that, you know what, there's not going to be a budget this year.
Yeah.
And then yesterday, the House voted to pass, it wasn't yesterday, it was the day before, but they voted to pass the Disclose Act, which basically tries to overrule what the Supreme Court ruled unconstitutional in McCain-Feingold. The Congress is coming back and saying that, you know, everybody needs to be up there disclosing what they're disclosing. You know, you need to have the CEO, but, oh, wait, the unions don't have to do that. The AARP doesn't have to do that. And here is the kicker that kind of struck me as odd. The NRA doesn't have to do it, but then the Gun Owners of America do.
Yeah, go figure. And, you know, let me just answer your first question there, Josh, about Steny Hoyer talking this week in Pelosi that there won't be a budget. And let me tell you, and I talked to a radio station up here locally about on the day that they came out with that announcement. Those guys are cowards. And I can boldly and confidently call them cowards. Because, you know, the only job Congress really has is to pass a budget. The only job I have as a state representative of the state of Indiana, constitutionally duly sworn, is to pass a budget in this state. If those guys are too cowardly to do what the Constitution tells them to do and what they said they would do when they raised their right hand and took that oath, then they need to leave those seats. They're not worthy to be there if they can't muster the backbone to pass a budget and be completely legit with the American people and with Hoosiers and transparent about how much debt they've gotten this nation into. With $14 trillion looking at us next year, this is an abysmal failure of what's happening in D.C. I think it's an outrage. I think people ought to hold their feet to the fire and hold them accountable. And then to have the gall and audacity to jump into that Disclose Act, which is all about getting more government power grab hands onto things that the government has no business in whatsoever, which is private industry, private organizations, and the ability that Americans have to actually dissent to their government. And so we're seeing another massive power grab. It means that these guys haven't heard from voters. They're not listening. And they have not heard what the American people have said, which is, you know, stop the political games, get back to the business that they're hired to do, which is to get this country back on track. And they're obviously not doing that. And so I think it's very cowardly.
Hi, Representative Walorski. This is Christy Kelly. And I have a question for you. You know, clearly we need to slash the budget, and we have a great our national debt is astronomical. But something else that I think we need to be concerned about slashing is legislation. You know, we have like the Disclose Act, and then this latest so-called financial reform. And something that did surprise me, though, was the NRA is typically considered pretty conservative, but yet they supported this unconstitutional Disclose Act. What do you think would be behind that?
You know, I don't know. I did hear Wayne LaPierre say this week. I was shocked. When I heard that, number one, I thought it couldn't possibly be true. I did hear a disclaimer by Wayne LaPierre this week, the president of the NRA, saying that they are excluded, but they still vehemently disagree and do not support that piece of legislation. I don't know. I guess, you know, that question would probably have to be directed to Wayne LaPierre to find out, you know, what are they thinking. But I was shocked. It's not in the character and the tradition of the NRA to be involved in, you know, stepping aside the Big Brother government there and allowing a power grab like that to happen. But I don't know, because I really haven't talked to anybody from the NRA.
What do you think is the reality of this legislation becoming law?
Well, I would say with the mentality these guys have, which is a lot of, you know, thug political politics coming from Chicago, I would say that these guys are going to push this agenda until November, and they're going to push this thing until there's no tomorrow. And obviously, they want to make sure that the government has their hand in every single piece that they can get their hand in before this election, before they lose Congress. And I think the reality, and what I'm finding out is this, and just being out in public constantly, I am out there constantly, and every single time they pull a shenanigan like this, the American people are not buying it. They call it a power grab. They're tired of the arrogance, and they're tired of those people in D.C. not listening to them. And so, you know, what's going to end up happening, Chrissy, they're going to push this envelope way too far and fall off the edge, and Republicans will get Congress back because of the arrogance of this attitude of not stopping and listening to the American public.
Many of us, you know, we do believe that, you know, we're going to have a turnover of power here in November, and we're all looking forward to it. But what about the damage that can be done with this lame duck administration, Congress, if you will be clearly trying to push through as much of their ideology as possible? Will there be any, will we be able to slow it down? Will we be able to turn it over?
Well, don't forget, the lesson I learned as a freshman in the Indiana House in 2005 is the most powerful group of people in D.C. in January are going to be the freshman class. And I learned that when I came into the State House in Indiana. We had the most closely divided House in the nation, and therefore the freshmen, nobody could pass a bill. The Republican caucus cannot pass a bill without my vote as a freshman and my colleagues that came in with me. And therefore, we learned really quickly, the six or seven of us, you know, around a table, that we would drive the policy and the agenda for the state of Indiana in that term, and we did. And so I was telling National Journal Magazine a couple of weeks ago when they interviewed me and four other candidates, they were asking about kind of like what you're saying. It's kind of like how can one congressman make a difference? What can you do when you have, you know, a Democratic president? And my answer will be the same to you, is the people that are going to drive the agenda in January are going to be the freshman class of whatever party is in power. And my money is on the Republican freshman class driving the agenda of the nation. We are the closest people to the ground troops right now of what people are saying, what they expect, and what they want. And what they want is they don't want party rhetoric. They want leaders, new leaders, to be elected and to stand up and have a voice and to keep those American people engaged at the table. And that's exactly what I plan on doing. I plan on filing a defunder of the health care appropriation bill in January to kill that thing right in its tracks before taxes kick into the state of Indiana and take our economy down the tubes. I mean, and to lead on that issue. And you know, and to vow not to hide behind these votes, but to visibly and vocally lead and take on this Obama administration. And I think we'll be successful. And I think Barack Obama's a smart man. If he's going to run for president in 2012 for re-election, I think he's going to have to figure out how to work and compromise with the Republican Congress. I can definitely guarantee you I will be in the lead at the table.
Thank you, Jackie. We really look forward to that.
Thank you for your leadership in the State House, Jackie, and for the charge that you're doing in running for Congress in the 2nd Congressional District. We wish you well. We want everybody to make sure to check out Jackie's website, JackieWilorski.com, where you can find out how you...
It's StandWithJackie.com.
I'm sorry, Jackie.
StandWithJackie.com. It's okay.
StandWithJackie.com, and...
Yep.
There you can find out how you can donate to her campaign. Check her out on Facebook and on Twitter. Jackie is everywhere. Jackie, thank you for your time, and we wish you luck on the campaign trail.
Thanks, you guys. It's great to hear from you. Have a good day. Have a good rest of the weekend. Take care.
Bye. That was our segment with State Representative and 2nd Congressional District candidate Jackie Walorski. Right now we're going to have you listen to the one-minute endorsement from Congressman Eric Cantor, and we'll be right back after this.
I'm Congressman Eric Cantor, the House Republican Whip. I'd like to take a moment to introduce you to Jackie Walorski from Indiana's 2nd District. For the past 6 years, Jackie has kept her promise to fight for common-sense conservative solutions in the Indiana State House. America is at a critical crossroads, and the road we take will determine the kind of country we want to be. We need to end Washington's culture of reckless spending. Jackie is a proven conservative leader who can help us bring fiscal sanity back to our nation's government. I'd like to ask you to join me in supporting Jackie Walorski. Please go to her website, StandWithJackie.com, and contribute what you can. Every dollar will help send Jackie to Washington, where she can join the fight for real conservative solutions. Thank you.
It's probably about 10 weeks and 5 days now, so you would have to do the surgical procedure. The surgical procedure is a dilation, like a DNC. It's just where they dilate your cervix and then use a vacuum aspiration procedure to remove the contents of the uterus.
What's fetus?
Fetus is what it's termed when it's in the uterus.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's not like a person.
Yeah.
When does the heart start to beat?
Usually you can start, it's around, I think, the 8th or the 9th week that you can hear the heartbeat.
There was, like, people out there and they had, like, pictures.
Yeah.
What is that? Like, what are those pictures? Where do they have
them? Are those real babies?
I don't know what particular pictures they have.
They're just nasty,
right,
like, abortion pictures.
Yeah, they're fake. There's no way that they could have obtained those pictures.
They had, like, a poster and they didn't talk to us, but it was kind of fake.
Yeah, there's no way they could have obtained those pictures.
What do they do with them, like, after they take it out?
It's disposed of just through medical waste.
It's not like killing a baby?
It's not a baby, it's a fetus.
but you, like, for the most part, everything, she'll be okay or everything will go
through. Oh, yeah, I mean, it's a very safe procedure. It's actually safer than carrying to term.
What's carrying to term?
Like, carrying the baby to term.
Well, like, having the baby?
Yeah.
It's safer?
Mm-hmm. In terms of number of complications, it's safer. Having an abortion is safer than carrying to term.
The abortion won't hurt me from having more kids in the future, will it?
No.
And welcome back to Gillespie. Our guest in this segment is Mike Fichter, who is president of the Indiana Right to Life. Mike, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
In our previous segment, we just listened to the recent video that came out last week from, I believe it's called Live Action Films. The outfit with Lila Rose, if some of our familiars are familiar with her, that basically it was a video taken on September 11th of last year at the Indianapolis Planned Parenthood Clinic. And the so-called counselor there basically just gives a very clinical view of a baby, of an unborn child. And gives incorrect facts and whatnot. What is your reaction? What has been the reaction from Indiana Right to Life on this?
Well, of course, last week we were very high profile in making this video available online and informing people that this new video had surfaced. And our initial reaction to it is how tragic it is that Indiana law has specified that women seeking abortion should be fully informed and receive full information as they're working through this decision. And what we see on this video is really tragic if this is the pattern that Planned Parenthood is using in informing women. You see in the video, for example, this person, I'm not sure what the official title would be, but telling the woman who is portraying herself as someone interested in an abortion and wanting to know more, telling her that the heartbeat of the unborn child starts, I think the quote is, sometime in the eighth or ninth week, which is completely against what we know from science. And then we also have the woman being advised that an abortion will have no impact on having kids in the future. There are a lot of studies out there that show that's not true. So it's very troubling. I mean, here you have a woman making women that are making this type of decision and receiving erroneous information, and it's a problem. It's a problem, and it points out, number one, Indiana's abortion law is not sufficient the way it's written right now, because the way Indiana's informed consent law is written, it leaves too many wide open areas. It doesn't require that informed consent be delivered in writing to a woman. It doesn't require the specifications. For example, informing a woman when an unborn child's heart starts to beat. So Indiana's law needs to change. This information needs to be prescribed by the state. It needs to be in writing, something that we can know is being delivered in a factual manner to women who are contemplating abortion. The second thing we believe that it shows, and this is something that we are already speaking very clearly to state legislators about, is that the state of Indiana should remove all state funding, including funding through contracts with Planned Parenthood. We should not be funding this organization. I think they get close to $2 million per year from state funds. That needs to end.
Well, Mike, obviously this is a pretty tight election year. I know that the Indiana House, which is currently controlled by the Democrats, they've been pretty cool, to say the least, towards any pro-life legislation. With a possible switch over in the Indiana House from Democrat to Republican, given that this year has a pretty strong Republican leaning to it, do you see this as an opportunity to pursue stricter pro-life legislation next year in the Indiana House, I guess regardless of whether the Republicans take over or not?
Well, yes. I mean, these two issues of tightening Indiana's informed consent law so that it's actually delivered the information prescribed is delivered in writing, and the defunding of Planned Parenthood are two issues that we will bring forward regardless of who controls the Indiana House. In fact, we have brought both of those issues forward in each of the last three, four, possibly five legislative sessions. But the reality of it is this, that if the Democrats retain control of the Indiana House in November, that we can talk about these issues. We will even have some members within the Indiana Democratic Caucus who will privately agree with us that we should defund Planned Parenthood and require informed consent be delivered in writing. But as long as Pat Ballard is the Speaker of the House in Indiana, and as long as the Democratic Caucus has its way with our legislation, these issues will be stuffed again in the Indiana House, and they won't see the light of day. So if we're going to advance this legislation, if we're going to be serious about defunding Planned Parenthood in the state of Indiana, we simply must have a Republican majority in the House. The Democratic caucus has proven to us time and time and time again that they are going to kill pro-life legislation. They'll do the same thing with this. In fact, when you look back on Indiana's track record in the past, I believe, 10 years, 2 years were controlled by Republicans, and in those 2 years, we passed three laws that Governor Daniels signed into effect. We had three additional bills that tragically were killed on the last few minutes of the 2006 legislative session, I believe. But we had a total of, I think, six bills that went through both chambers. The Indiana legislature. In the 8 years that the Democrats have controlled during that same decade, not a single bill backed by Indiana Right to Life has survived the House. So that's a very clear indication of how important it is that we have a Republican majority in the House in order to pass meaningful pro-life legislation.
Well, recently, as you're probably very much aware, Governor Daniels came out with his idea of the truce. And I think he was looking at it from more of a national perspective of what the next president would have to do. And basically, he's talking about putting social issues such as pro-life issues to the side while addressing the country's pressing fiscal matters. How do you approach something like that if Republicans get the House back in this next cycle and starting in 2011, being able to work with a governor who seemingly has given the appearance that he's not too quick to act on social issues, approaching these issues of tightening Indiana's abortion laws?
Well, I think we need to be very clear that Governor Daniels has been very instrumental in advancing the pro-life cause down the field during his time as governor of Indiana. And that's something that maybe people on the national level have not seen, but we have certainly seen it in this state. And here's the bottom line. We are fully confident that when pro-life legislation goes through the Indiana legislature, that Governor Daniels will support it when it gets to his desk. His track record has proven that. We've passed three bills that he signed into law through the Indiana legislature. It's under the Daniels administration and its BMV that we were able to get a Choose Life license plate in Indiana after working for years and years and years to try and get that enacted. We also have seen things such as the major medical errors report in Indiana that applies to ambulatory outpatient centers. It applies to hospitals. It also applies to abortion clinics. No previous administration would have dared to have tackled that issue and added abortion clinics into that as well. And even various agencies that the governor oversees, for example, the State Department of Health, we've raised concerns that abortion clinics were not turning in pregnancy termination reports in a completed and lawful manner. And when we issued those concerns and went through the proper channels, what we saw was a correction of that process where any incomplete report now is being returned and the abortion centers are being held accountable for submitting those reports as required by Indiana law. So when we look at the track record, when we look at a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff that happens with Governor Daniels' administration, we can have confidence that he is going to do the right thing on life issues. He will sign the bills when they get to his desk. I think that's very important that we keep looking at that and affirming the fact that we know we've made pro-life advances with Governor Daniels. We know we'll do more, but the block that's in the way is the Indiana House. And if we can get that flipped over to Republican control, we're going to see a lot of really good things happen.
Well, that's definitely very reassuring to know about Governor Daniels' record. And in all honesty, that's not something I knew all about. So that's, you know, definitely something that's been reassuring on my part. I know that, you know, after he did come out on the truce, he did say that he would support reinstatement of the Mexico City policy, which was definitely a comforting move to hear from him. Should he, you know, decide to run for president, which is still unclear, but. Anyway, to kind of get back to the video, what has been the Indiana Right to Life's response, and what can our listeners do to help help you with your cause?
Well, I know in our response right now, we're first and foremost raising awareness of this to just citizens across Indiana. We want folks to know how an organization that is just receiving a big chunk of its tax dollars is operating in the state of Indiana. So we have the educational component of this. The next level of it is we're making sure that Indiana state legislators are very well aware of this, because they will be the policymakers, and they're the folks that set the budget for the state of Indiana that will determine if money's going in this direction. So I think the number one thing that folks can do to help on this matter is to contact their local legislators, or, of course, we're in a major election cycle here. If you go to a candidate meeting and you've got folks running for public office, you need to ask them the question, do they think Planned Parenthood of Indiana should be receiving any taxpayer money, period? And it's a great opportunity right now to ask people that question, whether they be a candidate or somebody who is an incumbent legislator. You need to stand up and ask them that question. You need to let them know that you don't want your tax dollars going to this organization, and be laying that groundwork already for the defunding of Planned Parenthood, which we hope happens in the 2011 legislative session.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate your time and being able to be a guest on our show. And real quick, what's the web address for your guys' website?
Folks can go to irtl.org, get a lot of information on not only this but other things as well, and they can sign up for all types of stuff, free email updates, follow our Twitter feed and so forth. And we'd love to have people visit the site, send us some feedback. That's irtl.org, and we're glad to help folks any way that is useful to them, to provide them materials and alerts on things like this and so forth.
Okay, excellent. That is Mike Fichter, president of the Indiana Right to Life. Mike, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that is it for Gillespie. That is it for this segment of Gillespie. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Gillespie on FTR Radio. This is your host, Josh Gillespie. I thank you for sticking around. As you know, Saturday is September 11th. We will be celebrating the 9th anniversary. I don't know if it's necessarily a celebration, but we'll be... it'll be the 9th anniversary of the September 11th attacks on New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania. And I just want to recap for you my experience on September 11th. And this is actually from a post that I have posted on a number of the blogs that I have been a part of. And it basically is, this is my experience on September 11th. I was a young staffer. I was a fresh, green, not exactly right out of college. I'd actually spent most of 2001 as an unpaid intern working for Congressman Burton in his Indianapolis office when the opportunity arose to go out to Washington, D.C. And I got a job working as a deputy chief clerk for the Government Reform Committee, and I started on August 27th, I believe, or 29th, one of the two. And it was a tail end of recess, and we were getting ready for what was going to be our first hearing, or at least my first congressional hearing, on September 13th. And I remember that because we were supposed to have John Ashcroft testify. The congressman and the committee were looking into some activities of the Department of Justice. But on September 11th, things were a little different. I had arrived at work a little later than normal this particular morning, taking the red line in from Silver Springs, Maryland. I just started my job as a deputy chief clerk for the Congressional Government Reform Committee, chaired by Congressman Dan Burton, not even 2 weeks earlier. This was my first real job after college, and it took me away from my home state of Indiana and comfort zone. Little did I know that leaving home to work in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, a place I had wanted to work my entire life, would invite me into a world that had changed forever that fateful morning. It was 9:17 by the time I had sat down at my desk in the Rayburn House office building. The TV was on, which I found odd. My co-worker and office mate, Bob Briggs, hadn't arrived yet, so I wondered who had turned it on. I turned to see on the TV a building that had a large black hole in it. The TV was turned to Fox News, and it had the letters WTC underneath the picture. I know this sounds a little dumb, but never having been to New York City and not really giving it much thought, I had no clue that those letters meant World Trade Center. Not really getting what was occurring, I turned on my computer when I heard the replay of the second plane hitting the second Trade Center tower. I was stunned. The press office was next door to my office. And that is when I first heard the accusations that Arab terrorists were behind this. There was mass confusion. People were running around outside the hallways saying that we just needed to get out, but no one really had any answers as to why. We just needed to leave. But if we weren't yet convinced we needed to evacuate the building, we were about to be. Just after 9:45, I went out to the front office where the TV out there was set to CNN, and it had just cut to an image of the Pentagon after it was hit. The reports started coming in that another plane was heading towards the Capitol building. Mass evacuations all around D.C. were in full order. I tried to call home from an office phone, but either the lines were jam-packed or dead. I had yet purchased a cell phone, so I had no way of contacting my parents. Hearing that the blue line that ran through the Pentagon had shut down, I'd hoped to make it back to the red line back in Union Station before the entire metro shut down. Still absorbing the shock of it all, I left around 10 a.m. to head back to Union Station to go home. I felt no compulsion to run, so I walked. Instead of cutting across in front of the Capitol building like I had just moments before, I was now directed toward the street in front of it. There, people were running and screaming. Military personnel with guns were patrolling the rooftops of the Library of Congress and the Supreme Court building. I even heard a blast that was originally described as a bomb going off in front of the Justice Department. Turns out, it was a fighter jet breaking the sound barrier trying to head off Flight 93 that crash-landed in Pennsylvania. It was like something out of a movie, but this was real life. I ran into a random person who also worked on the Hill along the way, and we both tried getting on the metro. It was closed. I had no idea how I was going to get home. The streets were packed with cars going nowhere. I eventually ended up in the most unlikely place to see the rest of the morning play out, Murphy's Irish Pub, with that random guy and some of his co-workers. I had myself a Guinness. What? It's an Irish pub, and the world was going nuts. And I sat down with his friends. We were captivated by the TV and watched President Bush trying to understand this unfolding situation while trying to calm down a nation. The place was packed. The TV was as loud as it could go, which didn't seem very loud to begin with. And then the Taliban leaders got on TV to say that they weren't responsible. Not soon after the first tower went down, or not too soon after that, the first tower went down. I sat in the pub, just in stunned silence like so many others. We couldn't believe our eyes. Moments later, the second tower went down. It was like nothing any of us in that pub had ever seen. I was suddenly overwhelmed with fear and shock. Someone at the table I was sitting with let me borrow their cell phone. I was finally able to get an outside line to call my parents and let them know I was okay. I sat in that pub until a little after noon. Rumors started circulating that the Red Line Metro was open again. Finally, a rumor that was true. I headed home, stunned and silent like the rest of the passengers. I arrived home at about 1:30, emotionally drained, and watched the news the rest of the afternoon. What had just happened? Here I was, a stranger in a strange city, and I knew nobody. I don't remember much of the rest of the week, but I remember September 11th. I remember like it was yesterday. It was a day I was scared, worried, and fearful. It was a day that drew me to the only place I could find solace, the Bible. Reading through some of the Psalms comforted me and reminded me of God's control over everything. At the same time, I knew so much had changed that day. I remember that day. I will always remember September 11th. And the thing that really kind of stood out to me that morning as I was sitting in Murphy's Pub was watching the president. You know, I never really felt attached to any particular president. I grew up while Reagan was president, but, you know, I was so young, I really didn't, you know, hit me what was going on during my youth. And then during my formative years of junior high and high school, I had You know, there was George Bush and Bill Clinton. And really, again, nothing to get too excited over. And the election of 2000, that, you know, the way it was settled, it was I was supportive of President Bush, but again, you know, it was definitely seeming like he was playing it safe. But the one thing that really stood out to me that morning, other than the fact that his cool calm and his ability to lead a nation that was just in total shock, was it dawned on me that his cabinet, while many people wondered why he had a cabinet that consisted of Colin Powell and Donald Rumsfeld, and people were saying, well, this is just a very military-centric cabinet. And this isn't to float any of the conspiracy theories out there. I just think that the president was smart in choosing who he did for his cabinet because he had the right people around him at the right time. And his leadership really stood out. Sure, there are things that we can all look at President Bush and the way that he handled our nation in the days after September 11th. But I looked at him and I said that that was my president. And I was supportive of my president. I was supportive of my country. I remember going home that weekend just to kind of get away, even if it was just for, you know, a weekend, even though I knew I had to return back to work. I went home to sort of recharge my batteries. I spent some time with my parents. I'd gone up to my college alma mater of Purdue University to meet with some friends and even attended a concert there at a local church that just seemed to not only revive me spiritually, but also revive me emotionally and just really kind of got me through the rest. You know, the first hearing that I ever got to experience, the first congressional hearing, was a hearing on terrorism. And the first witness that I ever got to meet for a congressional hearing was Benjamin Netanyahu. And to listen to that man talk about what America will have to face against radical Muslim militants, you know, it gave us time to pause and reflect and know what we were getting into. Because I still to this day don't think that we really knew what we were getting into over in Iraq and Afghanistan. But we knew what we had to fight. We knew that we had to stand up for our liberty and attack the enemy. And that is what President Bush did. And to this day, I'll always be thankful for him and to every single troop who gave his or her life over in Iraq and Afghanistan for our freedom. Because to this day, even though the terrorists took down those towers, we are still a nation that is held together on freedom. And we may disagree with our leaders from time to time, but the thing is that we have what we have here in this country is something that no other country has. And the freedoms that we have in this country are freedoms that not every other country gets to enjoy. And we can't take that for granted. And as we look towards, you know, future elections, we know that we're not just fighting a war on terrorism, but in a sense, we're still fighting a fight for our own freedoms. And I want to encourage everybody to take this time to reflect on their experiences on 9/11 and to know that we are blessed in this country, that we have a God who cares for us, a God who loves us, and that at the same time, we need to be fearful for what can happen in this country, that freedom can be taken away at a moment's notice. Anyway, I encourage you to pray for our leaders and to pray for those around you. Pray for the families who lost loved ones on September 11th. Anyway, that brings us to the conclusion. Sort of a heavy conclusion, but a conclusion nonetheless to this week's show. I hope that you stuck around. We still have a full lineup for you ahead. Following our show, we'll have the Aaron Proctor Show, followed by Duke Over America at 10 p.m., the Smart Girl Report with Jenny Erickson, followed by the Armchair Energist at 11. Thank you all, and we'll return again next week with a full new show, and We look forward to having you back here on Gillespie on FTRradio.com. So long, and we'll see you next week.